May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
This is KPGZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, Washington, and this is Attention, Please. I'm Jim Burke, your host this week, and I spoke recently with Derek Kilmer, representative for the 6th District of Washington State in the U.S. House of Representatives. And I also spoke with Carrie Height, Director of Parks and Recreation Strategy for the City of Port Townsend. We'll start with the interview with Carrie Height. I'm here with Carrie Height, Director of Parks and Recreation Strategy. Good morning, Carrie. How are you?
Good morning. Hi, Jim. Nice to be here today.
Thank you for joining me. Tell me about the history of the golf course. Do you know, going all the way back to when it started being a golf course, do you know all that history?
Yeah, little bits and pieces of it. I mean, it started in the 1920s. We have a person that is on the golf club itself that went back and redid some historical perspective of the golf course. That's actually online, and people can see it online on the city's website if they want to read more about the history of the golf course.
And I have seen it on Envision Port Townsend Golf Course and, oh, wait a second.
Let's Envision Port Townsend Golf Course and Mountain View Commons.
Let's not leave out the Mountain View Commons.
Right.
So tell me about the stakeholder process and the study. So there was a study a few years ago about the golf course and the future viability of it. So let's start from there. When did that study take place, and what did it find out?
That was in 2019, and their recommendation to make it a viable course was to spend some capital dollars to upgrade the course, $1 million to $1.5 million.
Wow.
And then they had some recommendations on the operations as well. Mm-hmm. That particular recommendation that came through, there's a lot of people in town that really didn't agree with it, and so we're actually... In this iteration of the process, we've hired a golf consultant to either validate it or not validate it and do his own study on our golf course a municipal course, not a resort course, not a destination course, but a municipal course.
So the person who did the study a few years ago in 2019, it sounded like they were envisioning a fancy course.
It sounds like that. Yeah. And the recommendations were in line with what maybe a destination course might be. But this is a 9-hole course, so it's not really going to be a destination course. It's going to be a municipal course.
What is the current stakeholder process, and how did that begin, and what's going on with that?
We have 20 to 21 stakeholders, and the focus of the stakeholders really defined by myself in working on this framework to have a community discussion about the golf course in Mountain View Commons is for them to kind of take a higher level viewpoint and hold myself accountable and hold our consultants accountable to have a really good public conversation and listen to everybody that we can in town. And so they're not there to come to the table saying, we want housing, we want a golf course, we want, they're there to really just say, what are some of the decision criteria we should use as a town to just kind of take it one step higher and have that discussion of the criteria we want to use to make decisions, show up at the open houses and listen to the public, have conversations with family and friends and neighbors, and just really be the eyes and ears in town.
And on the open house thing, there is one coming up in January, isn't there?
There is. Thank you for asking. Yes. We have a open house on January 11th, and it's from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, and it's at the Fort Worden Commons.
Oh.
And we have a good presentation. We have some precedents, some boards of things, what things could look like, what a golf course could look like as well. And we're going to ask people to vote with thoughts and, just sort of put their input
their
onto
comment
the
cards to work.
Yep. So, and then we also have a virtual open house on January 12th. And that's important for people to understand. Just if they're not comfortable meeting in person, they can join us on January 12th from 4:30 to 6, and it's online.
Right.
And so the Zoom link is actually a Microsoft Teams link, is on the city's website for that as well.
Casey Dolan, last week, I think he did a little report on the last stakeholder meeting. He said it was quite cordial.
Yep.
And he said that there were some, the committee decided to highlight three options: adapted golf courses in which the very nature and usage of the golf course would be converted to a different use, including affordable housing, a park for public trails, sports fields, or returning it to Native Americans for their choice. Number two, a hybrid golf course in which both a golf course and open space for whatever usage could exist on the same property. and revitalize golf courses in which the property would maintain its identity as golf course but undergo mm-hmm. improvements. Mm-hmm. Does that sound like the three sort of yeah. the three things that are in tension right now?
Those are the three options in front of us that we're mm-hmm. talking about. And so if people come to the open house on the 11th, they'll see pictures of all that, and mm-hmm. they'll be able to give us their input on those options. But yeah, that's, I mean, really, it's golf course, not golf course, or a hybrid.
Right.
I mean, really, that's the three options.
Right. But I did notice on the history of the property that there were a deed restrictions on part of the property, but not the entire property?
There's not deed restrictions on the entire property, and the deed restrictions that are on a few of the parcels at the golf course are to be used for municipal purposes only. Not okay. That's the only restriction. It doesn't okay. say it has to be used as a golf course.
Right.
It doesn't say it
right.
has to be used as, you know, affordable housing. It doesn't say it has to always be maintained as a golf course. It mm-hmm. just says municipal purposes.
Well, and I mentioned this to you before and to anybody else who will listen, but of course I've not sent in comments or written anything down or drawn any maps, but I was trying to come up with this idea where the golf course, if they got rid of the driving range and they sort of folded up the golf course a little bit into either a par three or like mm-hmm. a links course, that would sort of be on this triangle mm-hmm. Where the current golf course mostly resides, but the side of is it Cherry Street?
Yeah,
that side okay. would sort of become an open walking space for mm-hmm. people, and then here along what street are we on?
Blaine
Street.
Yeah,
I knew it, mm-hmm. and I didn't say it. Blaine Street here would also have like a buffer between it and the golf course, mm-hmm. and so a person could potentially like walk on. From down at San Juan and San Juan and Discovery Road could mm-hmm. walk onto the corner of the golf course and then or the property mm-hmm. walk around the golf course
right
without ever being hit by a golf ball
yeah or, like have know. A perimeter walking
yeah,
trail for
yeah
people
that
to...
might not be on San Juan's side mm-hmm. the San Juan side, although the San Juan side has a little buffer there too
right.
And the other idea I thought of months ago was like to put townhouses along San Juan Avenue, just pack mm-hmm. them in there, you know, and see how many housing units mm-hmm. we can put in there. Now, this also brings to mind, if all these other things are in play and all these other things, if the city and the stakeholders committee comes up with all these different ideas, all of them would involve money, right? If we
Correct.
Put townhouses along San
right.
Juan, if we change
right.
the golf course configuration, if we left the golf course as is and we mm-hmm. tried to improve the irrigation system
right.
and so on and so forth, it would still require some money.
Yeah.
How would the city go about raising the money to convert or mm-hmm. to keep the golf course?
That's a good question, Jim. And part of what we're charging our consultant with is to phase in a plan. So if it does become alternative uses or it becomes a hybrid plan, what are the phases that we can add in? And every 2 years, there's a pretty robust grant cycle at the state.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to be prepared to be competitive during that grant cycle in 24,
right.
26, 28. And if we have phases that are lined out, we just have to come up with a small amount of match, not even 50%, to start to chip away and bring some of the ideas to fruition.
So having a plan is
yeah.
the key part.
Absolutely, a plan and phasing.
Right. So the key, so going forward after this open house in January, how many more stakeholder meetings are there and when do the final recommendations get presented
right.
to the City Council?
Thanks for asking that question. We actually have a stakeholder group every month through May.
Okay.
And then the final report and recommendation to council will be in June.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and the council really, ultimately, it's their decision. But our goal is to give them as much information as possible to make an informed decision about what their community and constituents want.
Sure.
And it'll be up to them to slice and dice it and figure that out.
Right. The water thing. So I've had mm-hmm. different... I have different information about different things. So the city actually fixed the well that was on the site of the
Correct.
Golf course?
Correct. Put in a well.
And they put in a well?
Yes.
And does that mean that the golf course would be self-sustaining in terms of water use?
No, it's not self-sustaining. We still would have a water bill to pay. We have
yeah.
about, $10,000 or $15,000 a year
right.
set aside for water usage at the golf course.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not too much. I mean, sure, it's a lot of money, but to most people. Yeah. But if my water bill was that high, I'd be upset.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things that a lot of people who are against the golf course talk about. They say, oh, the water usage. And then other people say, well, the city owns the water. Why doesn't the city just give itself the water for free?
Yeah. And more of what I've heard is the usage, not of the cost of it, but just the resources that we have in town. So using... Right. Some kind of herbicides or pesticides in water and mowing the lawn and having emissions go into the air.
Right.
Just sort of having the usage of resources and really impacting climate change in some ways.
Is the golf consultant or anybody looking at a more eco-friendly way of creating a golf course?
Yeah, that's one of the higher level criteria the stakeholders came up with is let's look at our climate, let's look at environmental sustainability, let's look at kind of the whole gamut of where are we going to be in the next 50 years, right? And how can we be responsible stewards of the land?
Right, because if it's like last summer, we get 4 months of virtually no rain and dryness. It's like maybe we need a desert course out there.
Yeah. There's some way to capture all the resources like from the storm surge yesterday, right?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yes. Carrie, I think that's all we got right now. So obviously, you're the stakeholders committee and you guys are looking at the costs and benefits and the way forward, and you're looking forward to some sort of a plan by June. And the once again, when is the open house?
The open house is on January 11th and 12th. It's the first open house. Mm-hmm. We had a project launch in October that was not designed as an open house. It was just a meet and greet. Right. So our first open house is in January, January 11th, 5 to 7 p.m., Fort Worden. We have childcare. January 12th is going to be virtual. The Zoom link is on the website. And then we'll come back, I think in April we have one scheduled, and in May we have one scheduled. So
fantastic.
Keep your eyes open. We'll get some word out on the streets of when those open houses are.
Okay, thanks so much for talking to me today, Carrie. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate being here.
Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Next, we have an interview with Representative Derek Kilmer, Congressman for the 6th District of Washington State, about the recently passed budget and the things that he helped bring to the counties that he represents, the 6 counties that he represents. I also asked him some things about the former president and the January 6th committee. An interview with Derek Kilmer, Congressman Derek Kilmer. So, first of all, the budget will be passed later this week by the House?
Yeah, the Senate's going first, probably voting Thursday, and then the House will vote on Friday, it appears.
What specific things did you work on in the budget for your district and Jefferson County and Clallam County?
Some huge wins for Jefferson County are included in this bill. I think a lot of folks have followed the Port Hadlock Sewer Project. You know, that's a project that can make a big difference with regard to new housing construction. Having the federal government step up and provide some financial support so that that project can move forward without the cost entirely borne by taxpayers in Jefferson County is a really big deal. And so the federal investment in that is $3 million. You know, just to give an example, I was out at that site. They said, you know, if this site is on septic, we can build 4 affordable housing units. With the sewer being put in there, Habitat for Humanity intends to put, I think, 160 housing units into that spot. They're able to do somewhere, I think it's between 100 and 160. So that is a huge deal just in terms of, you know, we know we have real challenges with regard to housing affordability in Jefferson County. And so an investment like that is really significant. On top of that, there's $2.5 million for the city of Port Townsend for their sewer pump station project. And again, that is a project that is really about housing and about jobs. So that area that's known as Evans Vista is designated for development of affordable housing. But one of the things that has stymied that so far is the need for a sewer pump station. And again, that doesn't sound like a sexy project, but it's a big deal in that it will enable the investment in, again, I think somewhere between 100 and 150 housing units. And if we're going to address some of the challenges in being able to live and work in Jefferson County, we have a real supply side problem. And so those projects are able to move forward.
This is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are listening to Attention, Please.
We were able to also secure, so you asked about Clallam County as well. There's funding for two of the tribes in the region for health center investments. The Macaw tribe, right now their health center is literally like right on the water, and the concern from a disaster preparedness standpoint is significant. And so enabling the tribe to invest in a new health center that's at higher ground is really important. That project's able to move forward. The Lower Elwha tribe also has a project related to their health center, and that project secured funding. And then finally, there is a joint emergency operations center project that Clallam County, the city of Port Angeles, the tribes, and others advocated for so that they're better able to coordinate. And that project we were able to secure funding for that. Really big wins for the north end of the peninsula. You know, this is why I serve on the Appropriations Committee, is to be able to advocate for our region and yes. for its needs, and being able to secure those funds. These are some big wins.
And when you do that, so I'm curious, because recently Governor Jay Inslee released his plan for the next year's budget, and it includes a lot of asks for housing. Do you, as a congressperson who is, you're answering to your constituency here in Washington State, do you actually coordinate with the governor's office and with local leaders to make sure that certain things like housing become top priorities for the state and for the federal government and for the counties?
Yeah, partnership is really important. And I will say, you know, Steve Theringer and Mike Chapman and Kevin Vandeweghe are really terrific partners as we navigate these projects. There's a lot of discussion. You know, Steve in particular, because he chairs the capital budget, you know, I've been able to give him a sense of, okay, you know, for example, down in Aberdeen and Hoquiam, where, you know, we've been working on trying to address flooding issues, to be able to say, okay, here's what we're getting funding for. Maybe you can take care of this piece. So there's a lot of collaboration on that front. The other thing is, I've approached this process of pursuing community project funding in a way that's a little bit different than most members of Congress, in that when we got more than 120 requests for 15 slots. I'm able to put forward 15 local projects that I'm able to advocate for. And so rather than it be, you know, being Derek Kilmer and his terrifically talented staff sitting in a conference room on our own picking favorites, what we did is we set up a community panel where we had leaders from each of the six counties that I represent, usually the Economic Development Council leads, and then a tribal representative, and then the head of the Minority Business Development Agency for our region, because they serve all six counties that I represent. And we gave them criteria to look at, you know, things like, you know, does this create economic opportunity, including housing as economic opportunity? Does this address a threat, whether it be an environmental threat or a public health threat or a threat related to the ability of folks to be able to live with dignity? Does it promote diversity, equity, and inclusion? Does it fulfill a federal obligation? Is the project ready to go? And does it have broad community support? And then we were able to, and that community panel was able to go through the more than 120 requests we got and really evaluate and rank order and score these projects so that there was more fidelity to the process. And what that meant was when I then, as a member of the Appropriations Committee, advocated within the Appropriations Committee, I was able to say, listen, not only am I saying these projects are important, we have broad community support for this. I had a community panel that went through this. And as a consequence of taking that approach, of the 15 projects I put forward, we got all 15 funded. And that's pretty rare. But really good news for our region.
It's impressive. And I've noticed that the city of Port Townsend in the last few years has started to do more and more engagement with local citizens. They have a special website on their site called Engage PT, where they work with the stakeholder committees to work on solutions to thorny problems, like the Sims Gateway here in Port Townsend. There are trees there that have been arcing into power lines for a few years now. And there was a whole hue and cry about that, of course, because the poplars are very popular. And, you know, people were very upset that they were going to take them down. But then once the stakeholder committee took it over and worked on it for nearly a year, It became clear that undergrounding the power lines created jobs. It helped them to expand the boatyard. They can redo the landscaping on the boatyard side so that the trees are more appropriate for the landscape and for the boatyard so that the boatyard can operate safely. Because right now, near that fence and near those trees, it can't. So that's just another example locally of how that's happening. So I appreciate what you're doing there. I also noticed last year you were, or maybe it's this year, but you've been working on a rules committee for the Congress. Is that right? Is that, do I have that term right?
The committee is called the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress, which makes us sound like the IT help desk, but we've been nicknamed the Fix Congress Committee. And about every 20 or 30 years or so, Congress realizes that things aren't working the way they ought to, and mm-hmm. they create a reform committee focused, simply put, on making Congress work better for the American people. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, as we talk, just today, this morning, we released our final report.
Oh, wow.
Our committee was able to make, on a bipartisan basis, Democrats and Republicans, more than 200 reform recommendations for making Congress work better. Everything from making Congress a place that's better able to attract talented people to work so that we have an institution that can recruit and retain and have more diverse staff that looks like America and is able to solve tough problems. Modernizing technology in Congress. Congress has been described as an 18th century institution using 20th century technology to solve 21st century problems. I think that's a pretty apt description. And so we made some recommendations on that front. We've made recommendations in terms of everything from the schedule and calendar that Congress goes by so that there's more opportunity for members to actually engage and problem solve. We made recommendations related to even things like civility and collaboration so that it's less of the Jerry Springer show and more of a place that's capable of solving big problems.
That's fantastic. I also saw here recently that you celebrated the passage of the Respect for Marriage Act.
Yeah.
Do you feel right now that being a Democratic congressperson in the House of Representatives, that you need to row your boat to the very end of this year so that when the Republicans take over some kind of control of the House, that there are certain things in place like this, the Respect for Marriage Act?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and listen, it's been over the last 2 years, you've seen extraordinary progress made by House Democrats. The passage of the American Rescue Plan at the very beginning of the Biden administration really kept our country from falling into a depression and stepped up to the challenge of the COVID pandemic. You know, for years, Donald Trump had talked about infrastructure, but never did anything. You know, every week was infrastructure week, but you never saw something pass. That changed because we passed an infrastructure law. And now we're seeing real benefits of that law for our region. You know, you saw the passage of a bill called the Chips and Science Act to try to drive more domestic manufacturing of semiconductors and chips here in America. Which will have a positive impact on inflation and on jobs. You saw the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which made significant progress on reducing healthcare costs for the American people. For the first time, allowing for prescription drug price negotiation under Medicare to lower costs for seniors when they have to buy medications, as well as the most substantial investment in combating the climate crisis in American history. And, you know, and to your point, we're not done. I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. on Friday voting on this spending bill, which has big wins for Puget Sound, for Jefferson County, for housing investment, actually making reform to the Electoral Count Act so that we don't see a repeat of January 6th again, trying to make some changes to how that Electoral College certification process happens.
Yeah, so on that,
so we're running to the tape. I mean, we're running all the way to the tape.
So that was actually my last thorny question. It's the elephant in the room. So the January 6th committee issued its final report yesterday, and they actually referred potential charges against the president, the 45th president, and others for the January 6th riot and insurrection. What are your feelings about the entire process of the January 6th committee and those referrals?
I give great credit to the folks who serve on that committee and to the outcome of their work. You know, I think it was important to have a real deep dive into what happened on that day, why it happened, mm-hmm. and how we prevent it from ever happening again. And, you know, as a consequence, the work that they did over the course of the last, you know, nearly a couple of years was really important.
Well, there's no doubt it was illuminating.
Yeah, very much so. Beyond that, I think the, you know, listen, I voted for the impeachment of Donald Trump twice because I think he's entirely unfit for office.
Right.
And certainly his actions on the 6th of January, you know, in essence, forming a mob that went to, you know, attack the Capitol in an attempt to avoid the certification of the Electoral College, I think was an absolute violation of his oath of office. Mm-hmm. And I think it's appropriate that the January 6th committee has suggested that the Department of Justice should consider whether criminal penalties should be part of that as well.
Does it feel personal, having been in Congress that day?
Well, I will say it was certainly the worst day at work I've ever had. and you know, my perspective on it is not just as somebody who sort of lived through it, but it's as somebody who really believes democracy is important and who believes that it's fragile. You know, thankfully, it was resilient enough to overcome 4 years of Donald Trump and an attempted insurrection.
Right.
But I don't think we can take that for granted. And so a lot of what I've worked on this reform committee in terms of supporting reforms to prevent the type of abuses that we saw under former President Trump has been driven by my belief that democracy is worth fighting for.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the KPTZ listeners about your work or about here being, you know, Washington State and where you live?
You know, the only other thing that I'll mention in the spending bill, you know, one of the things I grew up on the peninsula and, mm-hmm. you know, saw some of the economic challenges that we've faced. And so when we passed that CHIPS and Science Act, the American Competitiveness Bill, I was able to include a new program, a pilot program, that's focused on providing help from the Economic Development Administration to communities that have faced persistent economic distress. The Economic Development Administration will be able to provide some long-term, multi-year, flexible support to probably between 5 and 10 regions of the country mm-hmm. That have faced some economic distress.
Is this a new agency, Derek?
No, the Economic Development Administration has existed before. When I got into Congress, the entire budget for the entire agency was funded at $300 million.
Uh-huh.
Just for this new program in the spending bill that we'll be voting on this week, there's $200 million specifically for this pilot program to provide some long-term federal support for communities that have faced persistent challenges. And as the guy who wrote the bill, I'm going to fight like heck to make sure that one of those regions that gets picked is on the peninsula.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we know we've faced some economic challenges. And too often, the federal government takes sort of a one-size-fits-all approach to trying to address these issues. Mm-hmm. And so providing some flexibility to this, you know, a one-off grant can be helpful. But our community, our region, hasn't developed these challenges in 1 year. We're probably not going to pull out of them in 1 year. And so right. providing some longer-term, multi-year support is a really big deal. And so this is one of the things that I've been fighting for. And thankfully, in the spending bill, we got a big win on it. And I think, you know, for those of us who care about jobs and care about making sure that people can make a good living, regardless of what zip code they live in, this is good news.
Fantastic. Well, Derek, thank you so very much for talking with me today.
You bet.
Thanks for your time.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Have a good day. You've been listening to Attention Please, KPTZ's weekly news magazine. I've been your host this week, Jim Burke. Thanks so much for joining us, and Happy New Year.